All right, this will be Principles of Biblical Economics, Part 16, based upon the text, or at least based on many scriptures. But the text for this series has been Proverbs 10:22, which hopefully you now all have memorized. The blessing of Yahweh, it maketh rich, and he addeth no sorrow to it. And indeed, again, as I pointed out many times throughout this message, when God maketh rich, in whatever form his riches may come, there is no sorrow with it. It's everything that it's supposed to be. And it's a total antithesis to when man either makes himself rich or a government makes a man rich through all of its welfare programs and everything else that come with it. In some fashion, some way, either the person made rich or the ones whom are made rich by man or government, there is always sorrow with it, either for the one being made rich or the ones that are being stolen from in order to make those that are being benefited through those welfare programs rich. They sorrow in one fashion or another. Not so when God maketh a man rich. Thus far, I've addressed nine biblical economic principles for particularly personal financial success, although with a long-range view toward national economic liquidity, equity, and true prosperity, again, that only can come from God. Those nine economic principles, once again, thus far discussed, are: number one, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, seek work. Number four, tithing, free will offerings, and charitable giving. Number five, efficient and effective time management. Number six, Sabbath. Number seven, save all that you can save. Number eight, stay out of debt, or do your best to get out of debt if you're in. And number nine, do not charge usury, which we dealt with in the last two messages. The tenth principle of biblical economics that we'll be dealing with in this series, like the prohibition against usury, is repeated several times in the Bible. In fact, although usury needed to be dealt with or addressed separately, usury actually could be placed under this tenth and more extensive principle that we'll be dealing with in this message. The tenth principle, the tenth biblical economic principle, being Yahweh's requirement or mandate of equitable or just weights and measures. And let's just examine some of the scriptures that demand this principle of Yahweh's people. Let's begin by turning to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19, and we'll begin with verse 35. Leviticus 19, verse 35. It says, "You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment." And of course, that alone is a principle that comes up time and time again, that our judgment is to be equitable in all cases. When we make a judgment, or as a in a judicial sense, that judgment is to be meted out the same. We're not to govern or make distinctions in class, or in almost all instances, there are a few exceptions, in race or in lineage. There are a few exceptions, but very few, where God says your judgment is to be the same. There is to be no distinction. But it goes on beyond that. That principle is found throughout many, many times throughout Old and New Testament alike. But it goes on here. It says, "You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment." And then it says, "In meat yard." Not a term we're usually accustomed to using, but we'll get into that and explain it here in a little bit. "In weight or in measure." Verse 36, "Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall ye have. I am Yahweh your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." And of course, I think the reason he brings up Egypt there is because there was no equity for the Israelites in Egypt. None of that was just. They didn't have a just ephah and a just hin from the Egyptians. They got the leftovers and barely that. And so he compares it to Egypt. And then in verse 37 he says, "Therefore shall ye observe all of my statutes and all of my judgments and do them. I am Yahweh." Whenever God seems to want to stress something, especially in a strong, have it so that it has a strong effect, he usually ends it with, I am Yahweh. It's like, this is the reason. If you don't want to do it for any other reason, you do it, because I am Yahweh. And so he stresses it in that fashion in this passage. Now let's talk about some of the things that there was to be this just or equitable measure in. It starts off by saying a meat yard. Well, a meat yard was any surface measurement. You know, for example, a cubit, or in today's language, a yard, or a foot, or an inches, or acreage. You know, whatever was a surface measurement was what he was talking about. They were to have a just measurement as far as surface measurement. The surveyors would be under, for example, this statute, because they deal with the measurement surface measurement. Also, he mentions weight. Well, of course, that would equal anything or mean anything weighed. For example, a talent or a shekel. Now, most people don't think of talent and shekel as a measure of weight, but that's exactly what it was. Everybody thinks of it as money. Well, money, real substance, is always something of weight, of substance. And that's when they said shekel or talent, they weren't just thinking money in the sense that we think money. They were thinking a weight of money. Or we could talk pounds. Interesting. Isn't that what they have over in England? Pounds. Now, I don't know what they've got over there. They've probably done the same thing with their money as we've done with ours, and so a pound is probably no longer a pound. We can talk about troy ounce. A troy ounce was a measurement of money, but it was a weight, and it was a measurement of money because it had weight. Or we could talk of just pounds and ounces or anything of that kind. That it also mentioned that it was to be a just measure. Well, a measure was anything, a measurement of anything of capacity. And then it got very specific in the next two items by such as an ephah. Well, an ephah in that day and age was a dry measurement, much the same as our bushel would be a measurement of a dry measure. And then it mentions a hin, and a hin was a liquid measurement, as a gallon or a quart or a pint would be for us today. And so it was dealing with that. There was to be justice, there was to be equity in all of those things, in weights and measure. New American Standard translates verse 35 and 36 in this fashion. It says, "You shall do no wrong in judgment in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin. I am Yahweh your God who brought you from the land of Egypt." All right, that's the first time that just weights and measures are dealt with, at least that I recall being dealt with in the Pentateuch or in God's law. Turn now with me, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25, beginning with verse 13. Verse 13, whoops, that's 26. Verse 13 in chapter 25, it says, "Thou shalt not have in thy bag," the previous one dealt with from the positive, now it's dealing from the negative. It says, "Thou shalt not have in thy bag divers weights, a great and a small. Thou shalt not have in thine house divers measures, a great and a small." Now, what's it talking about, not having a great and a small? Does that mean you can't have measuring cups, the big ones and little ones and the ones in between? No, it wasn't talking about that at all. The first verse there is, "Thou shalt not have in thy bag divers weights, a great and a small." Literally, stones. Two different stones in your pocket. What they were doing is, especially in the days when they used the balances for to judge the weight of something, to balance it out, they'd carry around stones that had a specific weight. If they were going to, instead of having to carry a big bag of something, they'd maybe have a rock that represented a certain weight, and they wanted to buy, say, a measure of grain. They'd put the rock on one side, and then they'd measure in the grain on the other side of the balance until it equaled, and they knew they had the right amount. Well, God was saying, you're not to have divers measures. In other words, a great stone and a small stone. The great stone, of course, or the heavier to buy with, you'd put in it, it'd take a whole lot more grain to measure it out, and a light stone to sell with. And he was saying, you are not to do that. You're not to take advantage of your brother in that fashion. And then in verse 15 it says, but thou shalt have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall thou have, that thy days may be lengthened in the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee. And note particularly in verse 15, the blessing that Yahweh promises to those who are diligent. And by the way, don't think we don't use the balances like we used to. We don't have the stones in our pockets, but don't think that this doesn't apply today. I mean, there are very ingenious ways to be able to rob someone or to have an unjust or inequitable weight and measure when you're dealing in any type of commerce. So don't think that this still doesn't apply. But note particularly in verse 15, the promises that Yahweh gives in this verse to those who are diligent to maintain a just, who maintain just weights and measures. That is, equity in all of their transactions or interactions with others. And note, I not only said transactions, but interactions. Because this just weight and measures has to do with more than even just commerce as well, as we'll see by the end of this message. Yahweh declared in that passage that our days in the land will be lengthened if we maintain equitable weights and measures. The antithesis to that is that the life of a nation whose general policies concerning trade and commerce violate Yahweh's laws of just weights and measures will be shortened from what it would have been otherwise. God says, I'll lengthen it if you do it the way I intend you to do it, if you're honest with each other, if you treat each other with respect, and you try not to take advantage of your fellow man. He says, I'll lengthen it. But the antithesis is, if we don't do it and we go too far with it, he'll shorten those days in the land. And therefore, the people of the United States of America had better wake up, because they are in jeopardy of losing control of their country. And if truth be known, they already have. It's already gone that far. The idea of a government of, for, and by the people, which is, by the way, part and parcel of the problem. We should have a government. The way it was intended by God is that we have a government of, by, and for God, not of, by, and for the people. That's part and parcel of the problem. But even the idea of, for, and by the people is a joke today. The people are no longer represented by their elected... What's the word? They aren't representatives anymore. You got to put quotes around it. The whole word is supposed to intend that they be our representatives under that form of government, which again is still part and parcel of the problem. But they aren't representatives anymore. Just take the vote before this last war in Iraq, when President George Bush was taken before Congress about going ahead with it. That initial vote concerning his intentions to go to war with Iraq. Now, I don't recall. I think I shared this with you in a message a few weeks ago. But I believe, if I remember correctly, that it was at least 3-1 the response from the people to the representatives and to the senators that they did not want them to vote in favor of what George Bush wanted. And I think it was much higher than that. I'm taking the conservative here that it was 3-1. They were flooded with phone calls and emails and letters, and everybody was saying, the biggest majority were saying, no, don't vote with him. And what did they do? Every single one but one or two voted with George Bush. There is no longer a representation of the people there. Hasn't been for some time. America, lock, stock, and barrel, is in hock to the international bankers today. And each and every child born into this world, the moment they're born in as a citizen of the United States of America, is already in debt the moment of their birth. They're already in debt. Who do you think will be responsible tomorrow for today's debt and the interest that today's people can't pay? Well, it's the children that are born to every second, or whatever it is, here in the United States of America. Whereas once America, by the way, you've seen those debt clocks. That gives you an idea that there is no way that we're getting it paid, and therefore our children are going to be responsible for it in the future. Whereas once America was the greatest lending nation in the world, and for some time, until just recent, within the last, I think, 20 years even, whereas America was always the greatest lending nation in the world, it is now the greatest debtor nation in the world. And if you want to know why this is or how it happened, go read Deuteronomy 28. It's right there. And if you think that Yahweh isn't still true to those blessings and curses as found in Deuteronomy 28, America, past and present, is proof that He is still true to those blessings and curses. It's happening right here before our very eyes. The result of being in one place and then in the opposite place has all happened in the last 20 years here in America. From the greatest lending nation, think about that. Not just from a nation who wasn't in debt as much as the other nations. No, we were the greatest lending nation in the entire world. For 150 years. And then suddenly, we go from the greatest lending nation in the world to the greatest debtor nation in the world. All in fulfillment of the blessings and curses of Deuteronomy 28. One of the reasons that America is the greatest debtor nation in the world today is because because anyone who has looked into it knows just how inequitable America's monetary system really is. From the Federal Reserve, which I think everyone here knows, but I'm sure there will be some in the tape ministry who don't, from the Federal Reserve, which isn't even federal, it's a privately owned corporation. You want to talk about inequity, calling something federal that's not. That's what I think you could call that inequity, and at least in a fashion. But from the Federal Reserve, which isn't federal at all, to the whole tax system, to our whole tax system, to the local quote-unquote friendly downtown banker, to every merchant, or nearly every merchant, who likewise sells their merchandise at interest, or who debases their product and therefore represents it as something it's not. Now, normally we think of debasement, of debasing something, as in terms of money or coinage. And speaking of coinage, there was a tour guide who was showing a tour guide in Washington, D.C., and was showing some tourists around the D.C. area. And the guide pointed out to the place where George Washington had supposedly threw a dollar across the Potomac. And one of the tourists said, "Oh, there's no way, it's too far across there." To which the tour guide said, "Well, you have to remember, a dollar went a lot further then." And indeed it did. It was heavier. It had weight. It had substance. And therefore it went much further than a dollar does today. Now it's not even a coin in many instances. It's just this little flimsy piece of paper we put in our pocketbooks. But any product or merchandise can be debased. For example, gold watches that are no longer gold. Used to be gold watches were gold. They're not gold anymore. Or silk ties. You ever notice silk ties are no longer silk? Or very little silk. Cotton shirts that are no longer cotton. Or again, very little cotton. You ever ask for butter in a restaurant? You ever see what half the time, three quarters, seven, unless you say, "I want butter," who knows what you'll get? Let me tell you, if you're getting margarine that they call butter, I suggest you ask for butter, especially you men. Margarine is not good for manhood. It's one of those things that robs you of your manhood, pacifies you. Maybe somebody had intent there. Have you noticed brass bands are no longer Well, maybe brass bands are still brass. Maybe some things are still what they're supposed to be. But nearly everything in our quote-unquote modern society, everything else, I should say, in our modern, quote-unquote, modern-day society has been debased. A synonym for debased, by the way, if you look in a book of synonyms and look up debased, it'll say adulterated. It's adulterated. Isn't that what a cotton shirt has become? It's no longer a cotton shirt. It's advertised cotton shirt. It doesn't say 20% cotton and 78% polyester. They don't advertise it that way. But it's been debased. It's no longer a cotton shirt anymore. Or at least the kind of cotton shirts that our forefathers used to wear. And a large part of the problem goes back to the fact that our own government, the fact that all this merchandise and things that people sell have been debased, goes back to the fact that our own government has defrauded us by debasing our money. And we are victims of a trickle-down effect. And not that the individual merchant who's involved in it isn't going to be responsible before God, in spite of the fact that it's been a trickle-down effect. But nevertheless, because the Federal Reserve is not federal, and because our money is no longer real money, our gold watches are no longer gold. Our silk ties are no longer silk. Our cotton shirts are no longer cotton. And butter is not butter anymore. And the list goes on and on and on, because there's hardly anything in today's society of unjust and inequitable weights and measures that has not been debased as a result of what our own government has done to us over time. An unjust monetary system was part and parcel of the downfall of ancient Rome, and certainly has been at least a part of the destruction of probably every other great nation over the eons of time that have fallen. Ancient Babylon, for example. Take ancient Babylon, for example. You talk about unjust or inequitable weights and measures. Babylon had its beginnings in Babel. That's where the Tower of Babel was where Babylon existed. Had its beginning there. And most of us know the story of the Tower of Babel that's found in Genesis 11. But let me share you part of the same story as found in Jasher's account. And for those in the tape ministry who may not be familiar with Jasher, it's mentioned twice in the Bible, in the Old Testament, as what appears to be recommended reading. And Jasher fills in a lot of empty space that's not provided us, a lot of information that's not provided us in the Bible, and a lot of the accounts in Genesis and the first part of Exodus. And Jasher has the account. In Jasher, we find the account of the Tower of Babel. And let me read just part of it. Verses 20 and 21 to begin with. It says, And King Nimrod reigned securely, and all the earth was under his control, and all the earth was one tongue and words of union. And all the princes of Nimrod and his great men took counsel together, Phut and Mitzrayim, Cush and Canaan, and their families. And they said to each other, Come, let us build ourselves a city, and in it a strong tower, and its top reaching heaven, and we will make ourselves famed. Verse 25, And the building of the tower was unto them a transgression and a sin, and they began to build it. And whilst they were building against the Lord God of heaven, they imagined in their hearts to war against him and to ascend into heaven. And all of these people and all the families divided themselves in three parts. The first said, We will ascend into heaven and fight against him. The second said, We will ascend to heaven and place our gods there and serve them. And the third part said, We will ascend to heaven and smite him with bows and spears. And God knew all of their works and all of their evil thoughts, and he saw the city and the tower which they were building. Now, that was certainly the worst of what they designed, but there was more to it than just that. And then in verse 28, let me read this. It says, And behold, these ascended, and others descended the whole day. So this was during the building of this great tower that they had built in the city. And again, And behold, these ascended, and others descended the whole day. And if a brick should fall from their hands and get broken, they would all weep over it. A brick in the building, if it fell off the tower, they would all weep over it. And then it says, And if a man fell and died, none of them would even look at him.
In other words, you talk about inequity again. A brick was worth more to those who built the Tower of Babel than was the life of a human being.
And it's no different in Mystery Babylon. Let me read to you from Revelation chapter 18 and verses 11 through 13, where it's dealing with the destruction of Mystery Babylon. And as she has fallen in one day, it then says in verse 11, "And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise any more." And then it says, "The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen." You can see how the worth of it starts off with what they consider worth or most valuable to them, gold and silver, and it just gets less and less. Again, "the merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet of fine wood and all manner vessels of ivory and all manner vessels of most precious wood and of brass and iron and marble and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flour and wheat and beast and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves." And the very last thing that it says, "and the souls of men." Gold and silver and everything else in between in Mystery Babylon is worth more than the souls of men. Note, gold came first and the souls of men last. At the Tower of Babel, a brick was worth more, or esteemed more valuable than was a man. And it is no different for many people today in modern America. A large portion of our society clearly views man as worth less than, for example, than an owl, or a fish, or even a slug. John Davis, editor of the Earth First Journal, and that title says it all. But John Davis, the editor of Earth First Journal, had written this, human beings as species have no more value than slugs, end of quote. I'd say Mystery Babylon is well and alive. May not be the Mystery Babylon dealt with in Revelation, but there is a Mystery Babylon well and alive today. In the book called In Defense of Animals, Peter Singer, who is father of the animal rights movement, on page 6 said the following, quote, "There is no ethical basis for elevating membership of one particular species into a morally crucible characteristic. From an ethical point of view, we all stand on equal footing." Now, what's he talking about when he says all there? All the races, all of mankind? No, he says, we all stand on equal footing, whether we stand on 2 feet or 4 or none at all. End of his quote. Also in his book, Animal Liberation, pages 20 through 22, Peter Singer said, quote, or wrote, there will surely be some non-human animals whose lives by any standards are more valuable than the lives of some humans. A chimpanzee, dog, or pig, for instance, will have a higher degree of self-awareness and a greater capacity of meaningful relationships with others than a severely retarded infant or someone in a state of advanced senility. That's all preparation for euthanasia, is what it is. He goes on, so if we base the right to life on these characteristics, we must grant these animals a right to life as good as or better than such retarded or senile humans. Later he says, at the same time, the fact that a being is a member of our own species is not itself enough to make it always wrong to kill that being. And then later, this is why when we consider members of our own species who lack the characteristic of normal humans, we can no longer say that their lives are always to be preferred to those of other animals. End of quote. To many radical environmentalists, like the Club of Rome, man not only is less important, man is the enemy. This is from the book, The First Global Revolution, a report by the Council of the Club of Rome, by Alexander King and Bertrand Snyder on page 115, quote, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us," notice they're looking for an enemy to unite us, He says, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. End of that quote. And the inevitable inequity of all of that, the inevitable inequity of all inequities, is that to many people in today's society, to kill a baby whale or an owl is morally reprehensible. I mean, there's hardly anything that can be worse than that. Whereas to murder a human baby in the womb, or, as we've already seen, even a child or an elderly person that they no longer consider viable, is perfectly acceptable. Peter Singer, again, in his another book, Practical Ethics, second edition, page 191, he said, quote, killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often, it is not wrong at all. And he's not even talking about those in the womb. Inequity, in its many different forms, and certainly monetarily, has been at least part of the cause of the downfall of all of the great civilizations, beginning with the Tower of Babel, and, of course, Babylon itself. And I assure you that such inequity, and particularly as we're talking about in this message, monetary inequity, will also be the undoing, the ruin, the destruction of the United States of America as well. As for the present economy, you know, all of a sudden I was hearing we're out of the bear market and headed in the bull market again. You know, and as for the present economy, you know, the feds, quote unquote, and we better put quotes around them knowing that sometimes they're not really federal, but the feds are seeming to always being able to pull a rabbit out of their hat. And thereby are somehow able to keep this unscrupulous, crooked, dishonest, corrupt system afloat. You know, I know many of us have been aware of what's been going on for years, and you keep thinking, you know, how long can this go on? How many rabbits do they have in their hat? But one of these days, I assure you, one of these days, they're going to reach into their hat. And they're going to find no rabbit. Or, better put, the time is coming when they will discover that the people have figured out that there really are no rabbits, and never have been. Not real rabbits. That it's all been by the sleight of hand or the stroke of a pen. Our whole system today is based upon faith, and has been for some time. And therefore, it's really a religious system. You know, anything based on faith is religious. Religion. Evolution. It's a system, a hypothesis, that's based completely on faith. And therefore, it is a religion as much as Christianity is a religion. And this monetary system, let me assure you, is based on faith, and therefore it too is nothing but a religious system. As I pointed out in probably the very first message of this series, economics is religion. It's just a matter of whose religion you want. One that's based on faith alone, or one that's based on faith and substance. Faith in God and the substance that He provides in His monetary or economic system. In the past, at least the Federal Reserve notes were backed with a promise to pay in gold or silver. In other words, in substance, or what was then real money. But now there's nothing backing them. There's no gold. There's no silver. There's not even a promise to pay anymore in anything. It's all faith. The only thing that keeps this fraudulent system afloat, the only thing that keeps it afloat, is the people's faith that those Federal Reserve notes are worth more than the paper they're printed on.
Everybody believes that, so everybody goes out and uses them just like they were. And because everybody believes it, that they're worth more than the notes, than the paper they're printed on, and I assure you, there's nothing backing them, so that's all they're worth. But everybody believes, both the buyer and the seller, and so as long as they've got that faith, the system continues. But that's it. It's based only on the faith that they're worth something. And I highly would recommend Bruce McCarthy's messages and tapes that we've sent out previously at other times, and certainly can be gotten from him as well. There's probably no one who's better than Bruce McCarthy on that particular part of this subject. And when the populace finally figures out that the rabbits aren't real, that somebody took all the real rabbits, the gold and silver, and have them stashed away so that they've got all the wealth and we don't have anything, the system, when it's finally figured out, and the day will come, when it's finally figured out the system is going bust, and we will find that we are owned lock, stock, and barrel by foreigners today. By the way, when it happens, let me assure you that the real thing, gold and silver, is going to become very, very valuable. And therefore, when you can, if you can, buy some and hold on to it for yourself or for your children's sake for the future. Now, back to the scriptures concerning just weights and measures. Turn to Proverbs chapter 11. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 1. It says, a false balance is abomination to Yahweh, but a just weight is His delight. You know, we talk about wanting to be a delight to our Lord. Well, there aren't a lot of passages that use the word delight. Here's one of them. You want to be a delight to your Lord? Then use a just weight. Use a just measure. Jump over to chapter 16 and verse 11. 16 and verse 11, it says, a just weight and balance are Yahweh's. All the weights of the bag are His work. Well, there you have it. Yahweh has no part, therefore, in our present economic system, because only just weights and measures belong to Him. He has nothing to do with this inequitable, unjust system that we have today. And whatever, let me tell you, that Yahweh is not involved in the positive sense, is doomed to eventually fall. Yeah, they're pulling out the rabbits left and right. But one of these days, the rabbit's not going to be there. And it will fall. Particularly as it, you know, inequity in a lot of different ways, but particularly as it pertains to just weights and measures, if he's not involved in it, especially in monetarily, as we're talking about, it will indeed fall. Why? Turn to Proverbs chapter 20. In verse 10 it says, divers weights and divers measures, and having, in other words, having an inequitable one stone that weighs more than the other, depending on whether you're buying or selling. Verse 10, divers weights and divers measures, both of them are an abomination to Yahweh. Jump over to verse 23. Verse 23, divers weights are an abomination unto Yahweh. That's the third time we've heard that in the last three passages, that divers weights, unjust, inequitable weights and measures, are an abomination to Yahweh. And then it says, and a false balance is not good. Well, as you can see, this is no trivial matter with Yahweh. Unjust or unequal weights, in whatever they would represent for us today in commerce, is described in these passages as being an abomination to our God. Now, there are several things that are described in His Word as being an abomination to Him. I wouldn't say there's lots of things. There are some things He describes as being an abomination. Homosexuality is an abomination.
And man seems to understand that. Generally, man understands that that's an abomination. But you know, there's many a man who sees sodomy as an abomination, as God sees it, and who really doesn't see unjust weights and measures, how they deal with their fellow man in commerce, as quite the same fashion. Yeah, sodomy, homosexuality, that's an abomination. Well, but a little sly hand here and there to get the best of somebody, that's not really an abomination. Let me tell you, it's no trivial matter with God. He calls them both equally an abomination in His sight. And, by the way, it was for this sin that Yahshua, with a scourge, with a whip, drove the money changers, the bankers, out of the temple. I mean, that's the only time we ever find Christ dealing with a sin in that fashion, was with the money changers. All right, another passage. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 45. Ezekiel chapter 45, beginning with verse 8, it says, "And in the land shall be his possession in Israel, and my princes shall no more oppress my people, and the rest of the land shall they give to the house of Israel according to their tribes." So he's talking about a future time when things will be right. And then verse 9 says, "Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, let it suffice you, O princes of Israel." Here's how it's going to happen. "Remove violence and spoil, and execute judgment and justice. Take away your exactions from my people, saith the Lord Yahweh." Let me see how far I wanted to go. Verse 10. "You shall have just balances, and a just ephah, and a just bath," or another measurement of such. And then in the following, in the verses following those, and we won't go into that, it goes on to to explain exactly what the bath was to be, exactly what the ephah was to be, and so forth and so on. In other words, Yahweh didn't leave it up to man even. He had a precise standard that had to be adhered to as to what was a just measure and a just weight. Let's go to Micah, another passage. I'm trying to go through these without too much comment because we're going to run out of time if I don't. Micah chapter 6. Micah follows Obadiah. Chapter 6 and verses 1 and 2 to begin with. In Micah chapter 6 it says, "Hear ye now what Yahweh saith. Arise, contend thou before the mountains, and let the hills hear my voice. Hear ye, O mountains, Yahweh's controversy, and ye strong foundations of the earth. For Yahweh hath a controversy with his people, and he will plead with Israel." Now, let me stop there before going any further. It says that Yahweh has a controversy with his people Israel. And just in case you haven't figured it out yet, that's not good. When Yahweh has a controversy with you, that's not good. That's bad. There's never been anyone that he has ever had a controversy with that it hasn't ended up very poorly, unless that person dealt with the problem that caused the controversy. So just what was this controversy about? Among other things, we can read about it in verses 8 through 15. He says, "He has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth Yahweh require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God." Yahweh, verse 9, "Yahweh's voice crieth unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? Are there yet treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked? And the scant measure," that rock that didn't quite weigh what it should have weighed, that's what he's talking about. "Are there yet treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked? And the scant measure that is abominable? Shall I count them pure with the wicked balances, and with the bag of deceitful weights? For the rich man thereof are full of violence, and the inhabitants thereof have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth." Speaking specifically of the rich who usually take advantage of the poor. Sounds a lot like James chapter 5 and verses 1 through 4. Verse 13 of this passage, "Therefore also will I make thee sick in smiting thee, and making thee desolate because of thy sins. Thou shalt eat, but not be satisfied. Sounds like Haggai chapter 1 and verses 5 through 9. Remember, and he goes on further to use almost the same language. You sow much, but reap little. He says, and thy casting down shall be in the midst of thee, and thou shalt take hold, but thou shalt not deliver, and that which thou deliverest will I give up to the sword. Thou shalt, verse 15, thou shalt sow, but thou shalt not reap. Thou shalt tread the olives, but thou shalt not anoint thee with oil, and sweet wine, but thou shalt not drink wine. Now let me assure you that what these passages are saying is that you defraud your brother. And God says, I will quote-unquote defraud you, because it's never defraud when God does it. He says, you defraud your brother, and I'll defraud you. It's the law of you reap what you sow. If not from your fellow man, then by God. Amos 8, 4 through 7 addresses the same issue. It says, hear this, O ye that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail. By the way, this doesn't just deal with the rich as we normally think of them. If you're someone who takes advantage of a brother, whether you're of the same monetary level or not, you are taking advantage of your brother, and it still applies. You're rich in that state because you're taking advantage of him and making more of a deal than he would make. Hear this, O ye that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath that we may set forth wheat? You know, they just can't wait to get back to commerce. But it's worth more than that. Making, it says, the ephah small and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat. Yahweh hath sworn in his excellency of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of these thy works. End of quote. You know, caught with unjust weights or measures, or undetected by man, by your fellow man, be assured, caught or uncaught, detected or undetected, be assured that Yahweh will judge such people, and when he does, it will not be pretty. I mean, again, it is much an abomination in his sight as is sodomy. But more often than not, man's wicked ways catch up to him before the judgment of Yahweh, and in as a consequence, a person's name and reputation is therein lost forever. There's a story told of a lady who went to the butcher shop looking for a chicken for dinner. And she asked the butcher to see the selection. He only had one chicken left, but did not disclose this to the lady. He kept the chicken in the bin below the showcase, and so he reached down and pulled out the last chicken. He put it on the scale, and the lady eyed the weight and asked if he had one a little larger. Yes, he replied. He took the chicken and lowered it down into the empty bin, shook it again against the side, and brought it back out. This time, when he placed it on the scale, his trained thumb hung just a little on the edge of the scale. The lady eyed the weight and said, "That is fine. I'll take both of them." Now, do you think that lady, having discovered in fact what this merchant had done, do you think that lady ever did business with that merchant again? You know, he probably lost hundreds of dollars of future business from her and from everyone else who she conveyed the story to. All for a few measly dollars that might have been gained in that one short moment by his fraud. Now listen to me. Especially you younger people. Well, it goes for all of us. Your name and reputation gained by and through honest dealings, through just weights and measures, is worth far more than anything you're selling. If your name and your reputation is no good, it won't matter how good or even how superior your product is. Because without a good name and a good reputation, you'll never sell your superior product.
Take Enron, for example. The debacle here in the 2001 or 2002 concerning Enron. You know, their name was so soiled in that economic debacle of what they did that one of the baseball fields that was named after them, that had Enron as their name for their field, like Coors Baseball Field in Denver, Colorado, has now changed it. They wanted no part of that name. They wanted no part. They didn't want any chance of being associated with that company. Enron has also become the brunt of many jokes. This is called How Enron Learned Economics. A concrete truck driver moved to Texas and bought a donkey from an old farmer for $100. The farmer agreed to deliver the donkey the next day. The next day, the farmer drove up and said, "Sorry, but I have bad news. The donkey died." "Well, then, just give me the money back." "Can't do that. I went and spent it all already." "Okay, then just unload the donkey." "Well," the fellow says, "what are you going to do with him?" "Well, I'm going to raffle him off." He says, "You can't raffle off a dead donkey." He says, "Sure I can. Watch me. I just won't tell anybody he's dead." A month later, the farmer met up with the ready-mix driver and asked, "What happened with that dead donkey?" The farmer says, "Well, I raffled him off. I raffled him off. I sold 500 tickets at $2 a piece and made a profit of $998. The truck driver says, "Well, did anybody complain?" And the answer was, "Just the guy who won. So I gave him back his $2. That's how Enron learned economics. And a lot of other people in this inequitable economic society in which we live today. You know, I actually kind of hate even sharing that story because somebody's going to pick up on that and think, "Hey, that's a great idea." And it was just $2, you know, that everybody lost. They didn't really lose hardly anything. What's $2? Well, keep in mind that the man who would defraud you of $2 will, if brave enough and given the chance, do the same for $2 million. And there's not a nickel's worth of difference, pun intended, between the two. They are both low down, no good thieves, whether they steal $2 or $2 million. It's like the fellow who was approached a beautiful woman and said, he said, "Would you have relations with me for $1,000? And the woman said, "Yeah, I'd do that." And he said, "Well, would you do it for $10? She says, "What do you think I am, some prostitute?" And he says, "Well, we've already determined that. We're just negotiating price." You know, the amount of the money makes no difference. A thief is a thief and a prostitute's a prostitute. If you want Yahweh's blessings, which far exceed anything that can be gained by swindling or outright theft, your quote-unquote bag must contain just weights and measures in everything that you do. Ours should be to live such honest lives that not even our enemies could tarnish our names or our reputations. You know, I heard John Weaver this last spring present a message wherein he talked about Robert E. Lee. I was amazed. I don't know if you've ever read or heard some of the things that have been said about Robert E. Lee. But what amazed me the most about what was said about Robert E. Lee, what was said about him by his enemies. Amazing. That man lived such a life that his enemies not only could say nothing bad about him, they could do nothing but praise him. That should be the object of our lives. Not for our sake, but to give glory to God because it's ultimately Him whom we serve. Church leadership qualifications. Look at what's required. The term blameless. Think about that. That they must not be just near blameless. It says that they need to be blameless. Blameless is mentioned three times in Titus 1, 6, and 7. And in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and 2, and then in verse 7 of 1 Timothy chapter 3, it also says, "Moreover, he," the elder, the bishop, "he must have a good report." Where? Not only of those who are going to look to him as an elder, but it says, "Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without." the church.
2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1 says, having therefore these promises, and how many promises could we name? He says, therefore, having these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of our God. Just weights and measures, equitable in everything that we do. In fact, if it means that we must be defrauded ourselves in order that we don't defraud someone else, so be it. How many of you look at it that way? Hey, he took me, so I have the right to sue him for what he did to me. Isn't that the attitude? In fact, you don't even have to defraud somebody. You don't have to hurt anyone this day and age, you know, and they'll sue you just if they can figure out a way to try to make it look like you did. I know of a case right now that's going on. I pray for them daily that God would protect them for what's going on in their lives. King David, for example, understood the importance of keeping one's end of the bargain, even in a bad business deal. Psalm 15, 1 through 5. Sound familiar? Centered in on this passage in the last two messages on usury. It says, Yahweh, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell on thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh truth in his heart. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honoreth them that fear Yahweh. He that sweareth to his own hurt or damage and changes not. He that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent, he that doeth these things shall never be moved. If it means that we must be damaged in order to keep somebody else from being damaged, so be it. Joshua will also understand how serious it was to keep covenant even when the other party had entered into the agreement with disingenuous motives. Remember the Gibeonites who came to him after they had taken Jericho? In Joshua 9, verses 1 through 20, you might want to read about it yourselves. They came in, they lied to him, and he said, we still have to keep covenant with these people because we did so in the name of Yahweh. Just weights and measures should apply to how we handle everything in our lives, including, by the way, and I don't have time to elaborate on this very much, but including our time. And not only as it applies to an employer, there's an equal balance there. There needs to be an equal balance for what he pays and what you give in your time and how you use that time, but also to everyone else as well. You know, as already demonstrated in this series in an earlier message, time is more valuable than money itself, in that we would rather run out of the latter than the former. And yet there are people today who wouldn't in their life steal a dime from you, but who will steal your time. Not just from an employer, but also from you. Make an appointment. And I'm talking about people. I mean, there's always problems that can arise. But people who are notoriously, what's the other word I want? Always, that's not the word, habitually late for everything. They'll steal that time that's so important in your life. Even there needs to be equitable balances and weights and measures as well, if you will. The bottom line as it pertains to this 10th principle of biblical economics is if we intend to prosper, then it must be with just weights and measures as we commerce both in and out of the church, the ecclesia. 10 principles of biblical economics. Number one, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, seek work. Number four, tithing, free will offerings, and charitable contributions. Number five, efficient and effective time management. Number six, Sabbath. Number seven, save all you can save. Number eight, stay out of debt. Number nine, do not charge usury. And number 10, just weights and measures in everything that we do. 10 principles of biblical economics. Follow them, and Yahweh promises to prosper you beyond your wildest dreams. Rather than doing it man's way, where there is sorrow, where there is something always to pay and something always to lose, do it God's way, and he promises to prosper you. Let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer. Father, we